We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
Without stress, we'd be goners. But when the stress is chronic and is experienced as a threat, it's toxic. It ages us. It's being called the new biological clock. This morning, I invite your phone calls and email messages for health and science writer Thea Singer. She's the author of Stress Less. The book's subtitle tells readers that it's aimed at women, but there's plenty here for women and men, in particular young adults and people in middle age. The entire title, then, Stress Less, the new science that shows women how to rejuvenate the mind and body. The body and mind. The publisher, Hudson Street Press, a division of Penguin. Listeners, join the discussion with your questions and comments. Join us with a phone call or by email. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. And our email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Thea Singer has written about health and science for many years. Her work has appeared in numerous magazines, including O, the Oprah magazine, and Natural Health, and in newspapers, including the Washington Post and the Boston Globe. 333-9455, 800-222-9455, and the email address will-talk@illinois.edu. Thea Singer, welcome to the program. How are you?
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be on your show.
Okay. Well, it seems like stress is kind of like cholesterol in that there's good cholesterol and bad cholesterol. So what's good stress and what's bad stress?
Okay, that's a great question and a great way to start out. As you said at the top of the hour, if we did not have stress, we would be dead. Bruce McEwen, who is a stress guru researcher at Rockefeller University, actually gave me that quote from an Oprah article I wrote on the topic, and it's very true. We need stress to keep us alive. We need acute stress. That's the type that comes and goes. We experience it at times when we need to be revved up, we need to be excited, we need to be terrifically alert. Think, for instance, about the hunter-gatherer out on the tundra, which is why fight or flight, good stress, first came into being. You know, he's going out there, he's going to slay a moose. It wouldn't be good if he were feeling just lackadaisical and kind of lying around. Everything has to be on high alert. That's the good stress. When you're Juliet waiting to go out and meet your Romeo on the stage, that's good stress. What happens is when we're in situations where the stress never lets up, that's the chronic stress. That's when we get ourselves into trouble. Stress hormones, epinephrine, norepinephrine, and cortisol, which is the primary stress hormone, exist for a reason. They keep us going. But when our cells and our organs are constantly bathed in those hormones, that's when things start to break down.
Yeah. Speaking of a particular example of someone who is bathed in stress, in the first chapter of the book, we meet a woman by the name of Melody Morrow.
Right.
She is bathed in stress. Tell us about her.
Melody Morrow lost her home to foreclosure. I start that chapter off with a test on how much debt stress you have. And these days, all of us are really, whether we're in the dire circumstances that Melody is in, or we're just struggling to hold on to our jobs or just meet all of our responsibilities, we're constantly feeling ourselves under stress. And with the economy the way that it has been, we're experiencing that to an even greater degree. And what happened with Melody was she had a job, but her company was sold. Things went belly up. She had to basically start in a new kind of position, which she was not comfortable with. She had two daughters. She was a single mom. She tried to negotiate with the mortgage broker. We've heard these horrible stories before. She was fortunate in that she got hooked up with a real estate agent who helped her sell her house, and it was a short sale, and the mortgage company, the bank, said that was okay. But she went through terrific, terrific stress because it was her job she was dealing with, at the changes in her job at the same time that she was losing her house, which she put so much time and effort and money into.
And she's raising a couple of daughters.
Two daughters, yes. One daughter actually did go out and got a job helping. She was a nurse's aide in a retirement home, which was very helpful. But at the same time, her girls were teenagers, and so they were furious with her. Why did you put me in this position? And so she was suffering from a lot of guilt. She felt the weight of the world on her shoulders. She didn't know what to tell her children, and she couldn't see a way out. That's really the most important piece of this. What is stressful, after all, except when we feel that we are out of control? And that was the situation that she was in. She was out of control in her work life. She was out of control regarding being able to give her daughters what she wanted to give them. And she was out of control regarding her very home.
Was there any way for her to find some calm in this storm, or was she really, truly just under the gun all the time?
Well, she was under the gun, but there were strategies that she figured out for herself. Among them were she exercised, which I talk a lot about exercise in the book and how that is an incredible stress reducer. She also found support in her church and among family and friends. And there is scientific evidence that shows that social support and exercise actually can reduce our levels of stress. Regarding social support, it's not just that it reduces stress, but social support actually changes our brains. If you have social support prior to experiencing a stressful situation, your brain will react less strongly. The pain center of your brain, which is what reacts when you're experiencing stress, it's interesting, the same part of your brain lights up when you experience physical pain as well as emotional pain, such as stressors. And what scientists have found is that that part of the brain in people who are socially supported is less reactive. So it's not as if those people are dealing differently with the stressor. They are reacting less strongly to the stressor from the get-go.
Yeah. Now, you also mentioned exercise, and you've long been interested in dance.
Yes.
And while working on this book on stress, you began to think about dance. Why?
Yes. Well, I'm a former dancer myself, modern dancer, and I'm also a dance critic. I'm a dance critic for the Boston Globe. I have been for a long time. And it was interesting to me. I've talked to a lot of choreographers. I've seen a lot of companies perform. And it was curious. Choreographers and dancers not only seem to live longer and remain vital so much longer than the rest of us, but they're physically vital. They're mentally vital. Martha Graham was choreographing till she was 96. Merce Cunningham was choreographing into his 80s. He actually made a transition from choreographing in the studio to choreographing using a particular computer program. So he was, when he had terrible arthritis from his years as a dancer, and he could therefore sit in a wheelchair, actually, and choreograph dancers. But we're talking about people who were into their 80s and their 90s, and they're still creating new works. Not a lot of folks out there in a lot of different kinds of professions are doing that, and I wanted to investigate why that might be. And what I found was really interesting. There are particular, we've talked about social support, we've talked about exercise, and there are, it's also a quality of mindfulness and meditation that has also been linked with lower stress levels and slower aging. And it really does seem that dancers, choreographers integrate a lot of these interventions into their lives. They are keeping their minds active because they're learning new steps and very complicated kinds of choreography. So their minds have to remain nimble. They're careful about what they eat because in order to move their bodies the way they need to, they have to maintain a certain physique. They're exercising aerobically. They're exercising, they're doing weight and resistance exercise at the same time. They're working in a community, which is a huge part of being making a dance. When I was a dancer myself, I was always just amazed at the bonds that you formed and how you had to communicate nonverbally with all of the other players. And there's a spiritual component as well to all of the arts. So there was something about dancing and choreographing that brought together many of these interventions that I talk about in my book that can reduce stress and slow aging. Mm.
This is Focus, and in this hour of the program, we're talking about stress with Thea Singer. She is the author of Stress Less. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this morning with questions, comments. Join us with a phone call or by email. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Toll-free 800-222-9455. And the email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, now I want to move the conversation, the discussion, to a couple of other women whose names come up in the book, Elizabeth Blackburn and Alyssa Epple.
Right.
They did a study involving the effect of stress on DNA, and if I'm recalling correctly, this was published in 2004?
Yes, the first study that they did, the groundbreaking revolutionary study, came out in 2004, and they had a subsequent study that came out in 2006, and they continue to do research using a different cohort. The study that came out in 2004 was looking at moms who were caring for chronically ill children. A very, very stressful circumstance, a kind of no exit, no way out circumstance. They have, since in 2006, they were looking at a group of women who were caring for their spouses with dementia, and they have gone forward with that research and actually followed these women over a year or more, which is really fascinating. And what they found, now Elizabeth Blackburn won the Nobel Prize in 2009 with two other scientists, and Alyssa Epple is a health psychologist at UCSF. And the two joined forces. They looked at these women who were under chronic stress. They gave them a test called the Perceived Stress Scale, which is also in the book. And then they took a blood sample from these women. And what they were looking for was something called telomere length. And I'm going to give a little scientific explanation of that here. In our cells is a nucleus, and in the nucleus rest our chromosomes. Picture two worms crossed at the middle. On those chromosomes lies our DNA, the very substance of our being. It's very important that our DNA is protected. So at the ends of the chromosomes are little caps. Think of a shoelace with a plastic tip. The plastic tips keep the shoelace from fraying. In our chromosomes, these little caps, which are called telomeres, keep our chromosomes from fraying. They protect our DNA. Now, when a cell divides, not all cells divide, but many do, skin cells do, immune cells do, stem cells do, when a cell divides, the telomere gets a little bit shorter. So when we're younger, our telomeres are longer. When we're older, our telomeres are shorter. People with certain diseases, cardiovascular disease, for instance, immune system diseases, have shorter telomeres. So scientists look at the length of telomeres as a marker of biological aging. And what Liz and Alyssa found in their study was that the women who were caregivers who perceived themselves as being under the most stress had telomeres that were the equivalent of 10 years shorter than those who perceived themselves as being under the least stress.
So these telomeres are protectors.
They're protectors.
So how do we protect our protectors?
Protecting our protectors. Well, there's actually a lot that we can do. I'm going to throw in one other element here. It's an enzyme called telomerase. This is the enzyme that Liz Blackburn with two other scientists actually discovered, and that's why they won the Nobel Prize. Telomerase is a rejuvenating enzyme, and it can come along and dab little telomere repeats on the end of telomeres. So telomerase is kind of a telomere saver. And there are activities that we can do that science has shown correlate with higher levels of telomerase and also with longer telomeres. For instance, a study came out of England by a scientist named Lynn Cherkis showing that those who exercised had longer telomeres than those who were sedentary. There was a study done by a scientist named Cliff Cerone out in California in which he took a group of people on an intensive 3-month meditation retreat. And what they found was that those who were on the meditation retreat had higher levels of telomerase than those who didn't. And what they saw as the mediators in that was that the folks on the retreat had higher levels of perceived control over their circumstances. There have been other studies showing that telomeres in those who had higher levels of omega-3 fatty acids in their blood grew longer over a period of time. This was a remarkable study done at UCSF in which the scientists looked at a group of men who had cardiac disease, stable cardiac disease. And he noticed that some of them, over a period of 5 years, their telomeres lengthened. So he did a very intense analysis looking at statins and aspirin and physical activity and education level. And what he found was that those whose telomeres lengthened had higher levels of omega-3 fatty acids in their blood than those whose telomeres stayed the same.
Very interesting. We're talking about stress this morning with Thea Singer. She's the author of Stress Less, the new science that shows women how to rejuvenate the body and the mind. Without stress, we wouldn't be here for long. We wouldn't be here. But when the stress is chronic and is experienced as a threat, it's toxic and it ages us. And it's been called the new biological clock. And in a moment, we're going to ask our guest, Thea Singer, if we can turn that clock back. But right now, we have to look at the clock and say, we've got to bring in a message here, midpoint here in the program this morning. We need to talk with you, our listeners, and remind you that we are your local public radio station, and we rely on you and your contributions for about 40% of our operating revenue. Kimberly Cronick is here with me in the studio. She is our Director of Community Engagement.
And I loved the point that your guest made about the science behind how social support changes our brain, and it changes our brain's response to stress. And, you know, that's what a fund drive is all about. It's you giving your voluntary contribution to WIL, providing that social support to us so we can do the work in the community that you appreciate, whether it's bringing you programs like this one where we feature authors talking about issues relevant to your life, whether it's our local news, whether it's NPR news. The social support you give us with a financial pledge right now helps us continue to do this work. And the number to call is 217-244-9455 or go online at willpledge.org. Celeste, we wanted to, this is the first day of just a 3-day drive. Mm-hmm. We want to have 50 people pledging by the end of Focus. We were at 42 pledges, which means we'd like to have 9 more. And we can do that with your help right now.
And that number to call is 244-9455. 217 is the area code. 244-9455. Or you can go to willpledge.org right now and help us continue to bring you Focus and all the other programs you depend on. Focus celebrating its 30th anniversary.
Yay, we would love to be on for 30 more years. And Celeste, what's also neat is, again, we talk about that social support. The Common Ground Food Co-op is our partner in this, and for every pledge you make right now, they will donate the cost of 6 meals to the Eastern Illinois Food Bank, because we know hunger is an issue in our area, so your pledge goes just that much further. So if we get 9 pledges during the show, that is 54 meals donated to the Eastern Illinois Food Bank. But the main thing we need right now is for you to call and make that pledge, 244-9455 or willpledge.org.
And now let's go back to Thea Singer. And I put that question out on the table before I talked with Kimberly Cronick. The new biological clock, stress, can it be turned back?
Oh, you're asking me? Yes.
Yes. The new,
yes, it absolutely can be turned back. And those, some of the interventions we were talking about are ways that we can do that. I want to make the point that what's really crucial regarding stress is that we perceive the stress. It's not an objective thing. This is a really important thing to remember, because what you perceive as stressful might be different from what I perceive as stressful. You might be sitting there and be very comfortable in a traffic jam, and I might be ready to tear my hair out. But the fact is that what we cannot change that traffic jam, but what we can do is change our perceptions of that traffic jam. And that's the kind of thing that I talk about in the book, ways that we can change our perceptions of stressful circumstances. We talked about stress as a threat. What we want to do is we want to change our perception of an event from a threat to a challenge, because it's the challenges that are actually the good kind of stress. Exercise, for instance, is a stressor. It's a mild stressor. It doesn't go on forever. It's intermittent. And that's a good kind of stress. So we want to be able to try and change our perceptions of circumstances. One way that we can do that, actually, is through not putting on rose-colored glasses, because we don't want to be not honest with ourselves. But there are things that we can do to counter negativity. And this is important because studies have also shown that those who rated higher on a scale of pessimism had shorter telomeres. There's a scientist out in California named Judith Moskowitz who studies how to, quote-unquote, plant seeds of resilience. She works with people under very stressful circumstances. These are folks who've been recently diagnosed as HIV positive. And what she tries to do is to help them counter negativity. And she did a very exhaustive search of the literature on this and came up with particular skills that can really help people counter negativity. And I'm going to list some of those for you. One of them is notice something good that happened to you today and tell someone about it or write it down. Writing it down, telling someone about it, brings it out into the world, makes it that much more real. My personal favorite of hers is reinterpreting a negative experience. Let's say you're on your way to work and the bus is late and all you can do is see in your mind's eye your boss's scowling face. The bus comes along, another one comes along, you get on it, you're maybe 10 minutes late at this point, but you sit next to somebody who tells you a terrific joke and you can't stop laughing. You get to work, and what do? You stare at your boss's face and not forget that, or you reflect back on this joke and what a great time you had sitting next to this person. So that's reinterpreting a negative experience. I actually did this myself the other day. I went to my club to work out, and it was freezing here in Boston. It's really, the weather has been ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And so I get to the club and realize I've forgotten my headphones. So I start to get aggravated, and then I thought, you know what, walking back to my car is going to be my warm-up period. Then when I get inside the club and I hop on the bike, I can start at a more intense level. So I reinterpreted this interruption as basically a positive thing, my warm-up period, and it made a huge difference in how I was feeling. What's important with this particular strategy is that you pick something doable to reinterpret. You know, if it's freezing outside and the pipes burst and your house floods, that's not really reinterpretable. I mean, there are ways you can react that are more generous to yourself. But that's the operative word, is something that is doable. You want to redirect your attention to your strengths. You want to make a list of attainable goals for the week and work toward achieving just one. I really experienced this when I was writing the book. I would sit down and I'd say, okay, today I'm writing 5,000 words. And then I would say, okay, today I'm writing 1,000 words. Mm. And then it got down to, okay, I'm writing 500 words, and they don't even have to be good, they just have to be. And so I basically could then feel good about myself rather than being stressed about what I had or had not achieved.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting, when as I have been looking at your book and reading your book over the last couple of days, I was in a situation the other day in traffic and something happened and I got a little annoyed. And then I thought, not worth it.
Right.
Not worth it. It's like when you're confronted with, you know, food and you might be hungry and you think, you know, that's not worth the calories.
Right.
That's
right.
Not worth the load.
Right, exactly. And one thing that is very helpful, I talk a lot about mindfulness in the book. And I also present just a very short breathing exercise using diaphragmatic breathing. It's the instructions that a scientist at Harvard gives his subjects. He actually studies meditation and the mechanisms underlying it, what makes it work. And it's like as you inhale, you let your belly extend out, and you're breathing very slowly, and then as you exhale, you let that air out slowly through your nose, and it really makes a difference, and it physiologically makes a difference. If you breathe this way, your breath rate would be 4 breaths per minute or slower, and if you breathe this way, you actually balance out your sympathetic and your parasympathetic nervous system, and all of your systems kind of calm down. I do a lot of heavy breathing in the car when I'm driving.
Well, are all these strategies, if let's say, you know, some of us tend to be ruminators.
Right.
And we go over and over and over it.
Right.
Will these strategies help us turn that circuit off?
The strategies that the particular skills that Judith Moskowitz suggests are really, really very helpful in that regard. You know, for instance, you're reinterpreting things in your brain that you might be ruminating over. You want to concentrate on being mindful. I mean, if you're going out for a walk and you're hearing the crunch of gravel under your feet, you're not going to be hearing your 401k tanking. It's a matter of redirecting your attention and becoming conscious of your attention. And certain of these strategies, things like meditation, for instance, exercise, exercise is really wonderful. It's what I turn to in particularly stressful times. When I was writing this book, for instance, and my mother was in the hospital, I really started working out a great deal. And what happens with something like exercise and meditation is you're not just calming things down while you're performing that activity, but it actually changes your whole approach to things. It stress-proofs your brain, in a sense. Exercise can do that. Meditation can do that. One thing that scientists have found meditation does is that it really helps people gain perspective on things. And it's not just while you're experiencing the meditation.
This is Focus, and our guest this morning is Thea Singer. She is the author of Stress Less, the new science that shows women how to rejuvenate the body and mind. That subtitle tells readers that the book is aimed at women, but there's plenty here for women and men, in particular young adults and people in middle age. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this morning with questions, comments. The phone number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. And toll-free, 800-222-9455. And the email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Could we say there are demographics of stress? I said in, you know, my introduction and in my reintroduction that there's plenty of information here for all of us, women and men, young adults and people in middle age in particular. Who's under the most stress? Where does it appear? If we did a census of stress, what would it look like?
Well, some of the studies have shown actually that midlife women are the most stressed folks on the planet. And that's the reason that the book has the subtitle that it does have. I actually wanted the title of the book to be Stress, the New Biological Clock, Can You Turn It Back? But it is true that baby boomer women in particular, and even people younger, say starting at age 30, women starting at age 30 through 50, are under incredible stresses, and it's because we're in a sandwich situation. Interestingly, many of the scientists that I talk to are also among that population, including Liz Blackburn and Alyssa Epple. You know, we're the caregivers. That's not exclusive. It's not the case in every single household, but it very often is. And so we're caring for young children at the same time that we're caring for aging parents. We're trying to save money for our retirement the same time we're trying to save money for our children's college education. And there was a survey from the Pew Research Center on the sandwich generation, and it showed that a quarter of women, particularly those between the ages of 30 and 50, are in this position of caring for a parent or other older relative, and 54% of those in such a caregiving role said it caused them at least some stress, and 20% of that group said they were under a lot of stress. So we're in a position now, women are in a position where, you know, we're bringing home the bacon and frying it up in a pan. We're taking on more responsibilities, but not letting go of ones that we have had, that our parents, for instance, had. So we really are in a very, very tough situation. We also tend to ruminate more, as you mentioned about rumination before. We worry about things. I know my husband, for instance, he's, you know, men, this is again is a stereotype, but men are doers and women are more thinkers and trying to figure things outers. So whereas that can down the road be very helpful, it can put more pressure and on all of our organs and our systems and our brains.
Let's take some calls now. First, we're going to go to Atlanta, Illinois, line 4. Good morning.
Good morning. Great conversation. I wondered what the effect of pleasure reading would be on reversing the trends that we've talked about as far as stress, and in the same way that physical exercise does it. See if there's been any science work on that. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
That's a really great question. And actually, I did not come across any studies looking specifically at reading, but I did come across studies looking at other kinds of activities that bring people pleasure. And as a matter of fact, one of the things that I suggest in the book is that when you're feeling stressed, for instance, many people will reach for fatty, salty, sugary foods because those are seen as comfort foods. And what those foods do is they actually do kick off the reward center in your brain. That's the same reward center that's kicked off with drugs of abuse, not to the same degree, but it is the same circuit. But what can also happen is when we're doing anything that we enjoy, that circuit gets kicked off. And so one of the recommendations I make is, for instance, if you're trying to eat more healthfully or what you do is reach for those potato chips when you're stressed, don't then go reach for carrots because that's not going to do anything for you, but do something you enjoy. Listen to music, go for a walk. I go to the gym and jump on the elliptical, and I think that reading would fall into that same category. The reward circuit has two systems involved. One is the dopamine system and the other is the opioid system. The dopamine system basically is connected with wanting. It isn't the reward itself, but it sets us out in search of the reward. And then the opioid system is the system of liking. That's the one where opioids or endogenous opioids or endorphins, which you've heard of, that's the high that, for instance, runners get kicked off by doing things that we really like to do. So I think that any activity that brings you pleasure is going to kick off that system and is going to reduce your stress levels.
Mm. Let's take another call. This is a listener in Urbana on line 1. Hi.
Hi. It seems in talking with a lot of my friends that many of us women, I think this is, may also be true for a number of men, wake up in the middle of the night and then our brains start solving problems and then we can't get back to sleep.
Right.
And I had taken a yoga class for the first time. We were living in Kathmandu and I didn't have a task and there was this yoga class and I took it, and one of the best things that I learned from it was there's a final pose that you do in most yoga classes called the corpse pose, where you relax completely. And I had a wonderful instructor who also did guided imagery. And she had us do things like support our necks with a little rolled towel. We didn't have a pillow. Cover ourselves up because our body temperature was going to drop. She had us relax our tongues. And she said, if you notice a thought coming into across your mind, just let it go and come up with an image that you really like. And then she had us also breathe very slowly and deeply and count how long we could stretch our breath out to be. So we gave our brain something else to do.
Mm-hmm.
We also did adding the abdominal breathing, so your chest rose and then your abdomen rose and then vice versa. And I realized later on that I could go off into La La Land. I almost fell asleep. Mm-hmm. You know, other yoga instructors don't like you to fall asleep, but I realized after we left and I was having problems waking up at night, you know, maybe I could try this in the middle of the night. And I said to myself, you know, I can solve the problems or work on them during the day. My job at night is to get sleep and be rested so that I can function well during the day. And so I had an opportunity for lots of practice, and I got so that I could fall back asleep within a couple of breaths. Sometimes
that's wonderful.
Within just one breath. I do get out of practice, and I have to practice again when I hit a rough patch or something disturbs my sleep. But I do recommend it to people that you also set it up so you don't wake yourself up by looking at the clock. Turn the clock so you can't see it.
Right.
Set the alarm clock and just work on, if the alarm clock hasn't gone off, work on the process of sleeping and getting back to sleep and practice. I have a relative who does deep meditation, and when she was taking a deep meditation class, they were told to stick their tongues out. She said that she was told that if your tongue is tense, the thought centers, the language centers in your brain are also communicating with your tongue, and relaxing your tongue also helps break that mind hold over your your body. Which I thought was an interesting concept. I don't know whether that's true or not, but I thought it was also interesting that this yoga instructor had us relax our tongues.
Mm-hmm. That's a great point to make. It's not a part of our bodies that we often think of being tense, let alone relaxing. But in fact, if your tongue is not relaxed, you're clenching your jaw likely. So that's a great focus, and that really speaks to the whole concept of mindfulness. And I do discuss that in the book, even to the point of mindful eating. You know, it's really being in the here and now and paying attention to what's going on in your body and really trying to let go. And so that's wonderful. You also brought up the wonderful and really important point about sleep. And I do have a chapter on sleep in the book. Lack of sleep is a huge stressor, not just when you're tossing and turning and ruminating, but it also really sets you up to be under an incredible, it throws your stress hormones, it has them jumping through the roof. I mean, it's really does a number on you. And so I had spoken with some sleep experts, and I'm going to just run through some of the suggestions that are used in clinical practice to help people who are having trouble sleeping. One thing is, remember, sleep is important. And the caller, actually, you hit that right on the nose. You said, this is my time for sleeping. You know, when I'm awake is the time to be worrying about things. Often we say, oh, I don't need sleep, or I have too much to do. I don't have time to sleep. But think about it. You wouldn't get out of the shower before you wash the soap off. Well, you shouldn't get out of bed until you've had enough sleep to refresh yourself. There are 5 habits of good sleep. Go to bed and wake up at around the same time every day. Plan and follow a bedtime routine. Use the bedroom for sleep and sex only. Move the TV out of there. Don't even do your reading there. Read in the living room. Your bed is a place for you to sleep. If you're tossing and turning or even staring at the ceiling for 20 minutes or more, get out of bed, because what's going to happen is you're going to start creating an association of your bed with turmoil, and you don't want to do that. Design your bedroom for sleep. The caller also pointed to that. You know, throw a pillowcase over the alarm clock so you're not looking at the time. Make sure your cell phone isn't around. Keep the bedroom cool. There's a tip that was very interesting that a scientist named Jessica Payne, she's now at Notre Dame, told me. And she suggested, if you're anticipating sleep problems, to take a hot bath about 90 minutes before bedtime, or if you find yourself absolutely unable to sleep. And there's a mechanism called thermoregulation that then kicks in. You get in the hot bath, your body temperature goes up. In order to get into deep, slow-wave sleep, your body temperature has to be down. So when you get out of the tub, your body temperature drops very quickly, and it primes you and puts you right in the position to slip into that slow-wave sleep.
Mm. This is Focus, and our guest this morning is Thea Singer, author of Stress Less. 333-9455, 800-222-9455, will-talk at illinois.edu is the email address. Maybe you would give us a minute on diet.
Foods
we eat.
Yes, I will. There's one thing I wanted to bring up when we were talking before, though, when we were talking about social support, and this really plays into your fundraiser, that your pledge drive that you're doing right now. Social support goes two ways. You can receive it, and you can give it. And studies, there are scientific studies that show that giving social support by volunteering, say, or donating money actually can reduce your levels of stress, not only reduce your levels of stress, but can improve cognition. There's a study called, or it's actually an organization, a program called Experience Corps. And what this does is it takes older adults and puts them into schools where inner city schools where there is a limit and, you know, not very good student-teacher ratio. And these older adults work with the students. They work in the library. They do one-on-one conversations and tutoring with them. And the scientists, this was at Johns Hopkins, did brain scans of these volunteers before and after their volunteer periods. It was over 6 months. And what they found was that the parts of the brain that are in charge of executive control had actually improved over this period of time. So there are very, very great benefits to giving social support. Mm. To get to food, it's as I was saying, that often when we're stressed, many people are stress eaters. And there's a reason for that. There's actually a evolutionary reason for that. I don't know how many of your listeners heard about Oprah's interview with Piers Morgan and how she ate 30 gallons of mac and cheese when her movie Beloved tanked. But there's actually a reason that we reach for that kind of food. When we are in a stressful circumstance, digestion shuts down. Evolutionarily, we're programmed for digestion to shut down so that glucose, our primary source of energy, can go to the parts of our bodies that need it. Our thighs for running away from a threat, to our brains to make our eyesight more acute. But then once the stressor is over, it's time to replenish those used energy supplies. Well, these days, we're not out there doing physically stressful things. We're sitting in our cars or we're lying in bed tossing and turning. But our body doesn't know that we're not being physically active, and so the stress hormones react in the same way as if we were out on the tundra chasing a moose. So when the stressor has passed, it's time for us to eat because we think we need to replenish those sources. And that's why we reach for those fatty kinds of food. First of all, the sugar goes right to our brains. Second of all, those kinds of foods also kick off the reward center, and then we get into a kind of never-ending cycle of we kick off the reward center, we're calmed down momentarily, but then we get agitated again, so we feel that we have to eat more of the stuff.
Mm. Let's take another call. This is a listener in Terre Haute, Indiana, line 4. Hi.
Hi there. There's been a lot of talk about the stress factors associated with too little sleep. I'm concerned about people who are spending too much time sleeping. Mm-hmm. It seems to be especially a problem with the elderly, that they are in bed 10 or 12 hours a day. And it seems to me that their stress levels are often extremely high. Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering if there was any thought about that or any research on that.
People who are spending a lot of time sleeping are often depressed. And, I mean, I haven't looked at studies that specifically look at time spent in bed, but there are studies looking at when stress becomes so great that it tips into depression. And people who are depressed often can't get out of bed. There was a study done by Naomi Simon at Mass General that found that people who were diagnosed as depressed had shorter telomeres than those who were not diagnosed as depressed. So my guess would be that what's happening there is that the stressors have become so great that they have tipped into depression. Owen Wolkowitz out at UCSF has done a fair amount. He's a psychiatrist, and he's done a fair amount of research. He also works with Liz and Alyssa looking at depression and telomere length. And so I would guess that something along those lines is going on in those circumstances. Now, if you're looking at teenagers, for instance, who can sleep for, 15 hours, that's actually a good thing. So the population that you're looking at makes a big difference.
Mm. I want to thank the listener for her call this morning. And we're here at the point where we have to wrap up, but I wanted to ask you about something that Alyssa Epple wrote. She wrote the preface to your book, and Alyssa and, as you mentioned, Elizabeth Blackburn, they were the authors of this groundbreaking study involving the effect of stress on DNA that started this whole thing rolling. But anyway, she says, one of the things she says that I find very interesting in the preface to your book, Stress Less, is this. She poses this question, might policy, public health, and science converge to inspire a program of societal stress reduction? It's interesting on a couple of levels because it would be good for us collectively in terms of public health if we stressed less. But I'm wondering, collectively, is there a level of stress that is elevated?
Collectively?
I mean, as a society.
Right.
I mean, as a culture.
I would say yes to that, and I believe that Alyssa Epple would say yes to that as well. There are so many forces that we are dealing with now that our bodies and brains were not created to deal with. We were not created to deal with the kind of multitasking that we do. We were not created to be dealing with all of the technological advances that make communication and that social support that's so crucial and senses of community, they make it so hard. We think that, we're on Facebook, that we're linked up with, that social media is connecting us with so many people. But in fact, you're not reaping the benefit of one-on-one conversation with folks. So, yes, we are in a world that our bodies and brains are not prepared to deal with. And so I think that if we are going to be able to cope better with all of these wonderful advances, but which also can backfire, that we have to start looking more locally, looking at, the communities around us. And you see efforts going on. There's, people are trying to eat locally. People are trying to have community kinds of publications going out. So we are in a world that makes it very difficult for us to reduce our levels of stress, which is why the first step really is us recognizing that we have more control over how we see things and how we react to things than we initially think.
There we have to leave it. Thea Singer, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great.
Thea Singer is the author of Stress Less, the publisher Hudson Street Press, which is a division of Penguin.